siege on Gaza, one would think it's from a different era. As a result, a man-made famine is eating up bodies of babies and young children. The head of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, said more than 13,000 children have reportedly died in the Palestinian territories. Homes, schools and hospitals are in ruin. Teachers, doctors and humanitarians killed. Famine is imminent. Catherine Russell, the head of UNICEF, said on X, formerly known as Twitter, on Saturday, 6th of April. The United Nations humanitarian chief, Martin Griffiths, insisted on Saturday, 6th of April, that there needed to be a reckoning for this betrayal of humanity. The World Health Organization chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, pointed out that over 70% of those who have died in Gaza have been women and children. He said, "We urge all parties to silence their guns, and we appeal for peace right now."
Tonight on Exposé, mainstream media headlines deliberately held off Palestinian startling accounts of the kinds of abuses the Israeli occupation forces have been perpetrating against civilians in the Gaza Strip, as dozens of Palestinian women reported having experienced verbal and sexual harassment from Zionist soldiers. Digital media refrained from reporting about it, citing the Zionist narrative instead. And in the aftermath of the terrorist Moscow attacks, 77% of Americans believe the U.S. would be involved in any upcoming war with Russia in a new YouGov poll. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Horrific testimonies have been circling regional media of Palestinians trapped inside the Al-Shifa medical complex in Gaza, which has been besieged by Israeli occupation forces for the past 2 weeks before they withdrew on Monday. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert, more about it in Fake News Exposé. Israeli occupation forces stormed the Al-Shifa hospital 10 days ago, which housed over 7,000 patients and displaced Palestinians. It carried out executions and widespread arrests while bombing the building and its vicinity, leaving dozens martyred and wounded. Zionist media, however, has claimed that Hamas investigations have debunked the claims, saying eyewitnesses only wanted to arouse the nation's fervor. Fuad, whom do we actually believe, the Palestinians who encountered these violations or the Zionist media?
This is an easy question to answer, Marwa. This is the same Zionist media, of course, that's lied through its teeth for the past decades. How can we expect their version of what happened at Al-Shifa Hospital, or any other hospital for that matter, to be true when all these people came forward reporting all these testimonies, confirming the same horrific things that Israeli forces did at the hospital? We're going to start with testimonies broadcasted by Middle East Monitor on YouTube, coming in the form of reports by Canadian doctors, volunteering in Gaza about Palestinian women who have been sexually abused, assaulted, and humiliated by occupation soldiers in front of their own families at Gaza's hospitals, which have been under attack since the start of the war. Mm-hmm. It's unimaginable, Marwa, really, when you think that one Palestinian woman was raped for 2 days straight to the point where she was no longer able to speak. And nothing is being done about it. Mm-hmm. So this is according to the clinical professor of medicine, Dr. Aliya Khan.
I'm receiving reports from my colleagues who are on the ground now, and I just received a report that the Al Khair Hospital, which is next to Nasser Hospital, has been attacked, and the paramedics there informed the physician that a woman was raped for 2 days until she lost her ability to speak. Women are being raped. And this is not being publicized. No one is speaking about this in the Western media. Political leaders are not talking about this. Women are being raped. Another woman in the Nasser Hospital was stripped of her clothing in front of her husband and brother. And when one of them took their clothes off to cover her, the Israeli soldiers killed both, the brother and the husband. You know, this is unbelievable that this is happening today. Where are our leaders? Where is the global community?
Listening to this really makes our blood boil. It's unbelievable. I mean, we already have the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, saying that there's a plausible genocide going on in Gaza at the hands of the Israelis. And they have asked the Zionists to stop these attacks immediately. And there's been a complete disregard of what the ICJ is saying, what the United Nations is saying. Mm-hmm. And the U.S., of course, continues to provide the Zionists with the means of carrying out this war.
Top-notch weaponry all day long.
Continued flow of weapons, continued flow of funds, nonstop. And women are being raped, children are being bombed to bits, people are being burned alive, pregnant women are being mowed over by bulldozers. It's really, these are unbelievably horrific crimes. War crimes, massacres that are happening every single day, and life just goes on, no accountability. Obviously, Zionist media repeats the same magic words that they always use, anti-Semitism or blood libel, as they like to say. Mm-hmm. The Israeli channel I-24 News spread fake news, claiming this was just another story by deceitful Palestinians who have systematically been spreading lies since 7 October. As if it hasn't been an ethnic cleansing campaign since 1948.
Well, I'm gonna, with your permission, call this blood libel, because I think that it is just one example of vicious blood libel that has actually systematically been spread, not just since 10/7, but certainly on 10/7 and since 10/7, the worst attack of Jews since the Holocaust, that is actually fueled and enabled after being peddled on Al Jazeera and, as you said, other traditional media outlets that quote, let's be very perfectly honest, Hamas, a designated terror organization with genocidal intent to annihilate the state of Israel and murder Jews. And so in that sense, this is one example of the preposterous blood libel, which then fuels the false moral equivalence, not just on traditional media, not just on social media, but actually then peddled by politicians, by decision makers, by legislators around the world.
The Zionists have been actively involved in a genocide campaign against the Palestinians in Gaza for the past 6 months, but they have the nerve to cry genocide and compare themselves to Jews during the Holocaust, when a mere 1,700 Israeli settlers and soldiers were killed, compared to 35,000 Palestinian civilians, the majority of which are women and children, annihilated in cold blood since 7 October. Next, we have a testimony from Jamila Al-Hassi, who was trapped in Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Israeli forces have just withdrawn from that hospital after 2 weeks of bombing and burning and executing dozens of people, including children, and torture. This testimony was obtained by Al Jazeera, and the poor woman said that what she saw there was unimaginable. Mm-hmm. She said that women were sexually assaulted, abused, kidnapped by Israeli occupation soldiers.
These horrific testimonies were just testimonies until Monday, when we all saw what it is like inside and outside Al-Shifa medical complex.
Yeah, Israeli forces withdrew from the hospital, and we finally got a chance to see the massive scale of destruction that was inflicted on the hospital and its surroundings, and it's unbelievable. They killed entire families. Mm-hmm. They set fire to entire buildings, which innocent people were holed up in. They appealed to the Red Cross, saying they were stranded amid continuous bombardment. Children couldn't find even salt water to drink. And yet you get Zionist media propagating fake news and lies about horrific war crimes. And occupation forces actively refuse to comply with the UNSC and with the ICJ. It's a tragedy and a shame. After they withdrew from Al-Shifa yesterday, really, the videos that we saw were unbelievable.
they were horrific. They are something out of a movie, but these are humans. These are actual people who lost their lives, whose bodies are eroding in the streets of Gaza, in and around a hospital. A hospital. Where has that ever happened in the world? And the world just continues to not blink
Zero
to the Israeli entity crimes. Thank you for all of this very
Thank
important analysis and testimonies, Fuad, for our people all across the world. Now, ladies and gents, stay with us because we will continue with digital mainstream media. So in recent days, shocking testimonies of Palestinians about the kinds of violations committed by the Israeli occupation forces against civilians in the Gaza Strip have been making headlines. Among these are crimes of sexual violation and rape. Joining us now is our mainstream expert, Ms. Julia Qasim, with more on this issue. Floor is all yours, dear Julia.
Thanks, Farwa. So indeed, these testimonies have been widely circulated and are consistent with numerous previous accounts documented during the past months of aggression, including those by the pro-Palestinian Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor and others that the UN experts have treated with grave concern.
Mm-hmm.
So these speak of similar violations against Palestinian women in Gaza, and these documentations include various forms of sexual assault, including rape and threats thereof.
Wow.
So if we start with testimonies to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, female Palestinian detainees from the Gaza Strip report being subjected to sexual violence, torture, inhuman treatment, strip searches, sexual harassment, and rape threats while being arrested and held by Israeli army forces.
Mm-hmm.
So I quote, according to the testimonies of female detainees who were recently treated, who were recently released following various periods of detention, they endured severe treatment that amounts to torture, including beatings, threats of rape if they disobeyed orders, forced nudity, strip searches in front of male soldiers, and verbal harassment. So despite this, Marwa, mainstream Western media outlets have markedly underreported these well-substantiated accounts and offered them a lot less attention compared to the extensive covering of the fake rape stories.
In October 7th. Oh my
yeah,
God.
That have been debunked over and over again, yeah. As we also showed on the show, allegedly by Hamas. So they irresponsibly actually manufacture consent for perpetuating and covering up the real rapes of thousands of Palestinian women and girls and men as well in prisons, including children. Despite being proven to lack objectivity and professionalism, the fake rape stories are what we still hear about to this day on mainstream media. As we know, the Israeli occupation army launched another attack on the Al-Shifa hospital over 2 weeks ago, utilizing tanks and drones in an attempt to completely obliterate the remaining operational capacity of the medical complex, parts of which have already been destroyed in their last siege on it in November of last year. So the New York Times, in its coverage, adopted the Israeli occupation's narrative regarding the operation, echoing its claims of a high-precision operation targeting areas of the hospital that allegedly housed members of the Hamas leadership who had, quote-unquote, regrouped in Gaza's largest hospital, based on what the New York Times referred to as serious intelligence.
Wow.
So according to several Palestinian journalists, including a correspondent from the Al Jazeera network, the occupation's artillery shelled Al-Shifa Hospital and imposed a blockade on those inside. This was over 3,000, sheltering civilians, including medical staff, journalists, and displaced people and patients. So the New York Times also covered these developments in a detailed separate piece titled in a way that reinforces the Israeli narrative about, quote, Hamas's return to Gaza's largest hospital, consistent with the line dictated by the official Israeli institution. This approach represents basically a renewed breach of journalistic integrity and standards of accuracy and objectivity, and a relinquishment of the media's responsibility to independently verify information whenever possible and provide any context of what's going on. And essentially what they did is basically gave the green light for the massacre that occurred over 2 weeks of innocent people. Right now, the horrible, horrible images and footages that came out of the massacred people exhumed from their graves, completely their body parts mangled, and this is essentially what the New York Times signs off on when they.
I don't know how they
kind of
sleep
footage.
At night, Julia, when they report about this and then see the horrific. Are they seeing the horrific images that we are all seeing? I have a doubt in that, and I even have a doubt that they do really care about what happened to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip or anywhere else, for that matter. Thank you very much, Julia, for your thorough investigation to show us basically how the narrative of the Zionist entity is being imposed on major newspapers and media outlets, and they still refuse to tell the truth. It's horrifying. Thank you very much, Julia, for that. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to social media expose. As Western and Zionist media went silent on reports of sexual violence against Palestinian women in Gaza after the latest Israeli occupation's raid on the Al-Shifa medical complex, social media users took matters into their own hands. Here is Sima Itaim, our social media expert, with the details.
Thank you, Marwa. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
So the fact that major media outlets overlooked the news from inside Al-Shifa medical complex, which was besieged for 2 weeks, including reports of sexual violence against women specifically, demonstrates that they have abandoned their professional duty. Mm-hmm. And that duty is to highlight violations against civilians. Mm-hmm. It always has been. And this undermines the presumed role of the press in holding authorities accountable, especially those responsible for the occupation and under ICJ investigation for genocide. Mm-hmm. British activist Hussein Shafei expressed his anger over reports of women being raped and killed at Al-Shifa Hospital, stating that the starvation, death toll exceeding 32,000 and widespread destruction are insufficient to prompt action. Mm-hmm. Let us hear what Hussein had to say on Instagram.
Okay.
They're raping women to humiliate the men. This is their way of humiliating the Palestinian men. This is their way of saying you can't do anything about it. The messages I've heard that they were saying to people while they were raping them or while they were holding prisoners in the hospital, absolutely horrendous. Words to the effect of, we're going to rape you, there's nothing you can do about it. And when someone is screaming for help, they get shot in the silence, and anyone that's going there to try and help the voice, the people who are screaming, gets killed as well. This is just genocidal behavior. Rape is a weapon of genocide. It's used to humiliate and basically destroy the spirit of people. Israel has, this is another, yet another low. You know, every day I think to myself, it can't get any worse. You know, these things, these guys are such barbarians.
They are indeed such barbarians. That's what we saw after they withdrew on Monday from the Al-Shifa medical complex. I mean, the images were horrific, and I expect really social horrific. Media went wild also.
And what he said is correct, that actually rape is more a weapon of genocide specifically mm-hmm. than a weapon of war. Mm-hmm. And he also questioned what more needs to happen for Rishi Sunak and Biden to stop arming Israel to prevent these atrocities. Now on X, we have Mariam Barghouti, a Palestinian journalist and policy analyst, who posted the following. Israeli soldiers are conducting mass sexual assault on Palestinians and around Al-Shifa Hospital. They rape and execute, commit the crime and bury the victims and terrorize the witnesses. No words.
No words indeed.
Also on X, we have Khaleesi, who is a geopolitics and pro-humanitarian activist. She posted the video that you and Fuad were discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. Coming from an eyewitness inside Al-Shifa medical complex, saying the following. Listen, a horrific testimony from a Palestinian woman. On her exit from Shifa Hospital, she said women have been subjected to rape, starvation, torture, and extrajudicial execution. And the ICRC is doing nothing. Where are the human rights for Palestinians?
I think the ICRC would be shot dead if they even approach anywhere near Al-Shifa during the occupations residing in the area and committing these horrific crimes.
We've seen this. And since Khaleesi has 195,000 followers, the comments under her post, there were many comments. And here are some of the replies to her original post. Mm-hmm. Shakil, who is a South African filmmaker, replied, "Everything Israel accuses others of, they are doing themselves every single time."
Projection every single time.
Muhammad Azhar replied, "Where there is suffering, there must be voices raised in solidarity and action. Every person, every story matters. Our hearts are with the Palestinian women and all who endure injustice." Karim H. posted a screenshot of an article published by Forward, which is a Jewish digital media platform, and the article is entitled "Israeli Army Rabbi Once Justified Rape of Non-Jewish Women."
Mm-hmm.
Hit above the screenshot. "With the blessings of Army Chief Rabbi." Yeah. And the text for today is by Rawa Aouji,
mm-hmm.
who commented on the horrific text, saying, "Good morning, world. Israel inside the Al-Shifa hospital and rape. The Israeli army then killed fighters inside the hospital. Now you know. Keep doing nothing to stop the genocide."
That's basically horrific. I don't know what to say about it. Basically, it's showing us what the world is made of and what the people of the world are actually made of, because the world and its mainstream media machine just shut down in real time, shut down when all of this was happening, but social media was there, up and running and telling the truth. But to be honest, I'm afraid, because I don't know how much more time we have with this small window of opportunity to voice our support and voice the facts, just tell what the story of what's going on, it's the horrific Palestinian narrative of the horrific genocide against them. Anyways, I want to thank you very much, Seema, for your for showing us what social media said and for showing the world what the responsibility for each and every one of us is during these very hard times, especially as users of social media. Thank you very much, Seema, for your time and contribution to your show, to our show. Now, please do stay with us, because we will continue with Figures Exposé. Another topic that swept through traditional media and social media last week was the heinous and cowardly attack at the Crocus City Hall in Moscow. At least 133 people were killed and more than 100 injured after terrorist gunmen opened fire on concert goers and set fire to the venue in one of the deadliest attacks in Russia in decades. This attack brought about many questions, one of which is about the role of the United States of America in this act of terrorism. This prompted YouGov to conduct a poll asking Americans about the possibility of another world war, the role that other countries might play, the roles they themselves might play, and how the United States of America should respond to hypothetical nuclear attacks abroad and at home. Now, when asked if there will be another world war in the next 5 to 10 years, 22% of Americans think that it's very likely that there will be another world war within the next 5 to 10 years. 39% say it is somewhat likely, 18% not sure, 70% not very likely, and 5% not at all likely. Now, 32% of Republicans think it's very likely that there will be another world war in the next decade, 20% of independents, and 16% of Democrats agree. When asked if another world war were to break out, will the United States of America be involved? 77% of Americans believe the United States of America would be involved. Just 6% say the U.S. would not be involved, and the remaining 18% are just unsure. When asked if another world war were to break out, will Russia be involved? 72% believe Russia would be involved and would be on a different side than America. A similar percentage, with 69%, say the same about China. The countries that Americans are most likely to say would be involved in a hypothetical global conflict and on the same side as the United States of America are the United Kingdom with 67%, Ukraine with 58%, and Zionist Israel with 58%. Now let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. On Voices this week, social media users flocked the internet to oppose all forms of terrorism and to strongly condemn the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack. Here's our first voice with Rumium on TikTok, who posted a video with a caption, "Terrorism has no religion." Here's Rumium.
Terrorist attack happened in Russia. Four men with AK-47s entered a shopping mall and opened the fire. They killed 50 to 60 people and set the whole building on fire, which resulted to the death of another 80 to 90 people. After that, they managed to escape. These animals were heading towards the Ukrainian borders, but they were caught and arrested by Russian special forces. After some interrogations, they told Russian police that they were offered $10,000 to do this attack. The saddest part of the story is that nobody knows who are the organizer of this attack, because they told Russian police they were communicating with the organizers through the Telegram. Was it Ukraine? Was it ISIS? Was it somebody else that we don't know about? Only God knows. American embassy informed their citizens in Russia about upcoming threat 48 hours before the attack. How did they know? God knows. Why they didn't inform Russian special forces? God knows.
With that, ladies and gents, we conclude our exposé for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Exposé. The truth is just a revelation away.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. A British charity has launched a nationwide billboard campaign that calls on the British government to end its arms sales and trade agreements with Israel. The Human Aid and Advocacy, which works worldwide, has launched its No to Genocide campaign in 98 locations across the United Kingdom. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing mounting pressure over the country's arms sales to Israel, which assassinated seven aid workers working for the World Central Kitchen, WCK, in an airstrike in the Gaza Strip recently. In a letter signed on Wednesday, 3rd of April, more than 600 prominent figures, including lawyers, academics and retired senior judges, urge Prime Minister Sunak to end arms sales to Israel as a measure to prevent genocide in Gaza. They describe the present situation in Gaza as catastrophic, warning that the United Kingdom government is breaching international laws by continuing to arm the Israeli occupying regime. The signatories wrote, "While we welcome the calls by your government for a cessation of fighting and the unobstructed entry to Gaza of humanitarian assistance, simultaneously to continue to take two striking examples, the sale of weapons and weapon systems to Israel, and to maintain threats of suspending UK aid to UNRWA, falls significantly short of your government's obligations under international law." The 17-page letter further called for the government to work towards a permanent ceasefire and to impose sanctions upon individuals and entities who have made statements inciting genocide against Palestinians. It also stressed that restoring funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, is necessary for effective entry and distribution of the means of existence to Palestinians in Gaza, and by extension, the prevention of genocide in Gaza. The letter further emphasized that the International Court of Justice's conclusion that there exists a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza has placed London on notice that weapons might be used in its commission, and that the suspension of their provision is thus a means likely to deter and/or a measure to prevent genocide. While Conservative MPs have piled pressure on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak over the country's arms sales to Israel, saying the United Kingdom should stop exporting arms to Tel Aviv following the strike on World Central Kitchen aid workers. The Liberal Democrats, Scottish National Party, SNP and a former UK National Security Advisor have also called for arms sales to Israel to be suspended. First Minister Hamza Youssef has also urged an immediate end to arms sales from the United Kingdom to Israel in a letter to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. The Labour Party has not called for a suspension, but is urging the government to publish internal legal advice on whether Israel is in breach of international laws. On Tuesday, 2nd of April, Gaza's government media office said at least 7 foreign aid workers working for World Central Kitchen had been assassinated in an Israeli airstrike in Deir al-Balah in central part of the Gaza Strip. It said the foreigners included citizens of Australia, Britain and Poland. The British victims were identified as John Chapman, James Henderson and James Kirby, who were all military veterans. Speaking to the Sun newspaper, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak described the deaths as an awful tragedy, saying the United Kingdom wanted to see a dramatic increase in the amount of aid getting into Gaza. Sunak also called for an independent investigation into the Israeli airstrike, but stopped short of saying arms sales to Israel should end. The Middle East Eye has also covered the same story and tells us more. A British charity has launched a nationwide billboard campaign that calls on the British government to end its arms sales and trade agreements with the Israeli regime. The Human Aid and Advocacy, which works worldwide, has launched its No to Genocide campaign in 98 locations across the United Kingdom. Using quotes from Israeli Minister of War Yoav Gallant declaring a complete siege on Gaza, as well as pictures of starvation unfolding in the Palestinian territory, the British charity said it aims to mobilize communities to stand up for Palestine. Noor Chaudhary, the founder of the Human Aid and Advocacy, said the group had been organizing the campaign for nearly a month, but faced delays due to some advertising agencies cancelling at the last minute. Noor Chaudhary told the Middle East Eye, "We originally planned to go with one company, but despite our advert not breaking their terms and conditions, they refused because they thought it could offend someone." Chaudhary added, "We then exchanged emails with the company and found another one that said they'd take on our advertising if the Advertising Standards Agency approved it. The Advertising Standards Agency admitted that we might cause some controversy given the topic we're running an advert for, but concluded that it did not breach any of the rules." Responding to claims that the billboard campaign was provocative, Chaudhary said the advert was factual and that the Advertising Standards Agency had approved the facts before being placed on billboards. Chaudhary, who has a team working in the Gaza Strip, also told the UK-based news website that 18 members of his team had been massacred in Israel's incessant bombardment of Gaza over the past few months. He said, "There is a degree of hypocrisy in how, on the one hand, the United States and Britain are dropping aid and, on the other hand, they are selling arms, which is being used to kill Palestinians in Gaza." Chaudhary added, "The whole situation is dehumanizing to the Palestinians and creating havoc on the ground." The billboard campaign comes as pressure is mounting on Britain and its other Western allies to stop selling arms to the Israeli regime amid the rising death toll from the months-long war in Gaza, and warning by the United Nations that an Israeli-made famine is imminent in the besieged Palestinian territory. Also recently, British parliamentarians urged the British government to immediately restore funding to the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA, amid widespread hunger and an unfolding famine in Gaza. In a letter to the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, 50 MPs and members of the House of Lords urged the British government to reinstate funding for the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, without delay. UNRWA is the primary United Nations agency delivering healthcare and essential humanitarian support to the Palestinian population trapped in the besieged territory. In a statement in late January, the British government announced that it was pausing funding to UNRWA in the wake of Israel's baseless claim that the agency's staff were involved in Operation Al-Aqsa Storm. 115 parliamentarians called on London to pressure Israel not to use starvation as a weapon of war, to resume UNRWA funding, and set a deadline by which Israel must abide by the provisional measures of the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. The Israeli regime launched its war on Gaza on 7th of October last year, after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas carried out Operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the usurping entity in retaliation for the Israeli regime's intensified atrocities against Palestinians. The Israeli regime has also cut off fuel, electricity, food and water to more than 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip.
Citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives. But in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that, when processed, makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model.
My
Mark Rotenberg is an internationally renowned jurist. He has been heard many times by the Congress and the U.S. Senate for his expertise in the field of the Internet. He is the head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, one of the main associations for the protection of privacy.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen. I mean, I think there are some people who have this view. You know, it's our modern life. We'll just all get used to it. I hope it doesn't happen. You see, I hope it doesn't happen because I think such a future will be a digital prison. We will have the experience that people have when they're in a prison.
We abandon a part of our freedoms by accepting to be monitored in our private lives. In the field of surveillance, two viewpoints are nowadays coexisting and competing in the world. Some are rebelling against these violations of privacy in the name of individual freedom, while others consider technological developments as a preferred means of strengthening the security level. The United States, where the public domain may be monitored without any legal authorization, has developed an initiative for the pioneer collective surveillance, the NOLA Project. Citizens are at the heart of this community video surveillance project.
I can watch all 32 cameras at any time from any computer or iPhone. I was really excited when I found out that my crime cameras were linked directly to the cops. It's a new issue that the cops are getting help from private citizens, and I think in New Orleans it's important for the private citizens to become a part of crime fighting. Our police force is tasked. It's declining. We have certain issues that we don't have enough police force and enough eyes on the street.
The hyper-connectivity has enabled a former police officer, Brian Lagarde, to set up a private monitoring system with an unlimited development capacity. All the images captured by the citizens' cameras come together in this management center.
Project NOLA is greatly assisting the local police department because we're bringing citizens together. We're using modern technology, cutting-edge technology, and we're putting all this together where the citizens and the police, they're all combined together. Each one of these cameras, they're hosted on someone's home or on somebody's business. They're not on telephone poles. They're not on public property. And each one of these people are volunteering to host a camera, allow it to connect to their internet connection, where it then flows through into this building where we're able to record it free of charge.
In Europe, it is officially forbidden to film your neighbor's garden. But here in America, not only is this possible, the images may be broadcast on the internet.
Two of us, the two neighbors, we got together and arranged the cameras to point in two directions so that anyone going either direction on the street, we would get a shot of their face. So what you'll notice, this one's this way, and the other camera in my neighbor's house is pointed in this direction. And these are 3-megapixel night vision cameras. They're lit up by IR lights, so at night you can see a little bit of a red glow to them, and they work quite well. These are recorded inside the home, in my case, and Project NOLA, through the internet, has access to both of these cameras.
We can send the video to the responding detectives and police officers instantly. Two people robbed a lady. They beat her up. They took her purse. And what helped the police so much is, A, we're able to identify the perpetrators, and B, we have the perpetrator with the lady's purse, and then this perpetrator was actually smiling as he was running. So when he goes to court, he's going to have a very bad time in front of that judge because he was smiling. Of course, they're not going to like that very much. Each one of these cameras, all these 770 cameras that I have around me right now, they can all be used in a court of law for when the bad things happen.
Thank you.
we go. It's into this morning. And somewhere in here, I go off to work. There's probably an image of us standing outside the house. You'd be able to get their face. I think we're giving up a little bit of liberty, but we gain a lot in security. So it's a balance. And I think we found a pretty happy balance. And here's sort of the big point. We're winning.
The word security is increasingly associated with surveillance. We went to meet one of the world's leading researchers in this field. Sociologist David Lyon, a professor at the University of Kingston, leads the research laboratory of surveillance, where he has studied for 20 years the impacts of surveillance on our lifestyles.
There are questions about some balance or some tension between liberty on the one hand and privacy on the other, or security and liberty. There are various ways in which this debate is located. However, it seems to me that, again, the big questions still need to be asked. The word security is one of the most influential words in the world today, and it is also the least carefully defined. The definition of what is security leaves many, many questions, particularly as the word is frequently associated with national security. What is national security? Whose national security are we trying to protect or maintain? So questions like this, I think, are tremendously important ones.
Now we're going to meet those who think that security does not justify the renunciation of our fundamental freedoms. German engineer Carsten Knoll is an expert in technology. He gives us an appointment in Berlin, the Security Research Lab, his research laboratory on computer security. His company has gained international reputation by exposing the failures of mobile network carriers. He himself has broken the security code of the SIM cards that equip all our phones in order to reveal their failures. Now, if they want to reinforce the security of computer networks, they come straight to him. The science doctor knows very well how you can use these new technologies to encroach on anyone's privacy. And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon. But a week later, on September 11th, 2001, the attacks on America brushed aside this European initiative altogether. In a single day, the scope of the security measures around the world changed entirely. The U.S. president at the time, George W. Bush, signed the Patriot Act, the anti-terrorism law, which established the most ambitious surveillance project in history with the support of Europe.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the internet, and cell phones. As of today, we'll be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology.
the idea of terrorism was distilled into a particular understanding of terrorism, which of course in practice was frequently associated with particular groups. And so that designation came to capture what terrorism was supposedly all about. One of the problems with that is that the ways that surveillance were developed after 9/11 was to use the same kind of cover-all description, terrorism, terrorist, to begin to include other groups as well.
At the heart of the surveillance system post September 11, a man enjoyed all the attention of the U.S. president on security policy. Now a partner in an influential law firm, Stuart Baker was then the NSA's general counsel and deputy secretary in charge of internal security in the Bush administration. He is one of the implementers of U.S. security ambitions.
I don't think there's any effort or reasonable likelihood that the entire population of the United States could be controlled on pretty much anything. But in many cases, you do have to look at all of the information about the entire population in order to find people who are trying very hard to escape your notice, to try to hide from you. And often it is only when you look at the entire population that the people who are the riskiest, you don't know that they're guilty of anything, but you know that they are riskier than others, can get the attention that they deserve.
Security takes center stage in the U.S. government's policy priorities. From 2001 to 2013, the total intelligence budget gets doubled to reach 40 billion euros. A quarter of it is reserved for the NSA, the eyes and ears of the secret services. The agency's Maryland headquarters are off limits to investigative journalists. The NSA has provided us with official images worthy of a low-grade TV series where the same comedians appear in each plan to give us an idea of the work of 15,000 agents of the site. What is behind this pretense, behind which they can monitor the life of anyone, anywhere in the world? Of those who know about the agency's secret operations, only a few people have broken their silence. In a forest near the headquarters of the NSA, we meet Thomas Drake, a former Navy officer hired by the agency in 2001 to be in charge of the surveillance operations. A few months later, irritated by the processes, he opposes the hierarchy, putting his life in danger.
I confronted my immediate supervisor, the number three person at NSA. I said, "We're engaging in surveillance of Americans on an extraordinarily broad scale without a warrant." And he said, "You don't understand. Everything's different now." The phrase that was used was, "We live in exigent conditions." That means extraordinary means are necessary to deal with a threat. So, and he said, we just need the data. And then he said, "Don't ask any more questions. You don't want to go there." It was more than just a passing threat to me.
After these revelations, Thomas Drake was accused of high treason in 2006. He faced the risk of being sentenced to life imprisonment. After 5 years of proceedings, the charges were dismissed in the absence of evidence.
In 2006, I came under direct investigation by the U.S. government. Why? Because I was disclosing crimes being committed by the U.S. government against its own people in total violation of the Fourth Amendment. All done in secret because the executive decided, you know what? We don't have to have an open and free democracy. We don't need transparency. We will determine in secret what's best for the American people, and we will keep them safe on our terms.
A surveillance state, by definition, means that anything that it surveils is suspicious. Whether or not you're doing anything suspicious doesn't matter. By definition, you're subject to surveillance, which means you're automatically suspicious. And that's the real danger, that everybody is assumed to be suspicious until proven otherwise. It's completely flipped, even in the United States, what our system of justice is. But you just remember, all this is happening largely in secret. And they're not going to yield willingly. I mean, you see the power elite, okay, those who are in charge, they're not going to give this up lightly. It's a seductive thing to have all this knowledge available, all this data available, just literally at the tips of your fingers. In this case, if, you know, at a click of a mouse.
In Montreal, Ubisoft has done cyber surveillance over the engine of a video game, Watch Dogs. In this game, smartphones are replaced with firearms. It took 5 years of investigation and hard work for more than 400 developers to create Watch Dogs, a venture far less futuristic than it seemed.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God, in which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. A pregnant woman does not know whether fasting will harm her baby or not. Does she still have to fast?
Well, if she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would harm her baby, then it's not obligatory to fast. And if there's no such ground, there's no likelihood or fear that it might cause any damage to the baby or to the mother's health, which ultimately will have bearing on the child's health, then of course she must observe fast. Because I've seen many women who are very strong, very sturdy, and very healthy. Mm-hmm. Fasting does not affect their health. Right. And so they have to fast. It's not, when there's genuine fear that it might damage the mother's health and as a result the child's health, mm-hmm. Of course, she does not have to fast.
I see. A pregnant woman fasted, Sheikh.
Yeah.
When she delivered, the baby was found dead. Means that there was a miscarriage.
Yes.
From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she fasted nevertheless. Well, my questions are as follows. Was her fasting valid, first of all? And two, is she liable to pay blood money? Three, what is the ruling in her case if she didn't think that fasting would be harmful but later found it to be true otherwise.
Hmm. Well, if she fasted even after she had reasonable fears that fasting would be harmful and injurious to her health or that of the baby, or she discovered later that fasting was harmful to herself or her baby, of course, then her fast is invalid and she has to perform in its qaza, of course. But the liability of paying the blood money depends upon proving that her fasting caused the death of the fetus. You know, if it is established that it was